Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
Absolute shit, though. Imagine like tar and ash and dirt and burnt dirt, you know, that all rolled up in a black resin.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So let's get started. Welcome to Living in the Matrix, everyone. Today's a special day for me because we have a very good friend of mine, probably one of my best friends in the world, because we just have two minds alike.
Kevin, you're willing to admit that. I'm impressed.
Absolutely, dude. Absolutely. Because here's the thing. You and I have had probably some of the most wonderful conversations around life. And I think everybody wants someone like that in their life where they can just be honest and real. And you and I always have that. We always have a great bottle of wine, probably a good steak. And it's good to do life with people like you. So that's one of the beauties of having you on. So welcome, brother. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Jonathan. And if I can, if you don't mind me correcting you in front of your audience, we never only have one bottle of wine. I just wanted to get the record straight for everybody else listening to Jonathan.
Oh, yeah.
This notion that there's one bottle of wine, don't listen to that. Nah, that's not how it rolls. That's not how it ever rolls. That's definitely not how it happens. Exactly. There's usually one bottle each, but I digress. Jonathan, please proceed.
No, not at all. So I'm going to start out and really begin kind of setting the table a little bit of what I imagine for this episode, because this is, we'll see where this goes, but this is always an extension of one of our conversations that we have, and we talk about everything kind of like we do on this podcast. That's why I think the three of us have a tremendous amount of synergies, because we both like talking. We all like talking about things that really matter. And I think that's why we started. Kevin and you and I talked about Shit That Really Matters was the name of our original podcast idea. Uh-huh. And it's the truth is we're always searching for what's real and what's valuable. And what I love about the three of us is that we can have those conversations. So at some point in the future, we need to have a steak and a really good, a good bottle of Plum Jack or something like that.
Good.
Have you ever had Plum Jack? Rich?
Rich,
have you? Oh, of course. Yeah, I visited their winery on my 50th birthday, actually.
That's good juice.
Stellar wine.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many great Napa Cabernets. I mean, my friend's bringing a bottle of Colgan out to Utah. We're going to go out and do the Wave hike, which is in southern Utah, which is
also good juice.
Only a few hundred pieces get there. So, yeah. And I don't know if you're familiar with Sinequanon. And yep. So I'm fond of both his son's wines. His son's name's Nick Krenkel. He's got Fingers Crossed. That's his label. And then the man who made Sinequanon's wines for 12 years, his name's Jim Binns. I just cracked his Andremoli last night, and that was a Syrah from a celebration of my wife's birthday. And we're gonna crack the Mourvèdre next week as well. So it should be a fun time.
Nice.
We will spend some time on wine after this.
Well, you know what? That's a really good place to start, because it's something that we all love. Kevin, why don't you tell your story about how you found wine? Because I think it's one of the more interesting stories I've heard from you. Is you had this unique apprenticeship with a sommelier.
Oh, you would like me to talk about that right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's start.
Let's
there.
Let's dive in.
That's who you all are. Right. That is a big part of who you
Jesus
are.
Jesus just drank wine last night on the Last Supper. Jesus just broke bread and drank a cup of wine and passed it around. So let's celebrate. Good Friday, right?
Yeah.
So all right, Jonathan, I'll start there. I'll try to keep this succinct. You know, I grew up really dirt poor, incredibly underprivileged. So the notion of me even knowing how to spell wine, never mind be an aficionado, was not exactly how I started off. I escaped poverty in the Deliverance Country region of southern Missouri, northern Arkansas, escaped to Seattle, got a break and got to get a really nice Michelin star white tablecloth waiting job when I was only 19. They just thought I was a grad student, and I never lied. I just didn't correct them when they assumed that I was, you know, in my 20s as a grad student. We open up, we immediately close because this guy buys it. And I'm going to give your audience a little taste. Kind of description number one, when I say Liberace or early Elton John, people probably get that visual, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe 5'2", the boa, the come over, right? That's the visual, okay? Visual number two is big Neville Proud. Little 5 foot two Liberace body, big 7 foot six South African big swing, and you know what, ego and voice and brr. The third data point is the guy is the great grandson of one of the original South African diamond mine, billionaires. Mm-hmm. So the cat's got, you know, his slush money is his $100 million trust fund on top of what daddy, right? And he's never worked a day in his life. And then the fourth bullet point I'll give you is, I think hopefully a lot of your audiences know what a grand sommelier is. It's like the grand poobah of grand poobahiest of all wine. Today in 2024, there are about 274 grand sommeliers in the world. Out of 8 billion people, there's 274 grand somms. Back then, there's only 26. And this guy was one of the 26 grand somms. So Liberace, Neville Proud, trust fund baby, grand somm. That's who buys the restaurant. We open it back up. He puts in the best wine cellar in America. Opening night, he sits at the end of the bar, slaps down 17 or 18 cocktails. Doesn't talk to us all night. It's like, well, that's interesting. Pushes his way at the end. I'm the poor college kid. I need every penny. So I'm waiting the last table, washing the last dish, sweeping the last floor because I'm still dirt poor. He pushes himself out of the off the bar, staggers over, throws his arm around me. And okay, you know what I'm thinking now. It's like, oh, God. Oh, no. He's hitting on me. I'm going to say no. I'm going to lose my job. I'm not going to be able to pay for food and rent. I'm going to have to drop out of college. My whole 19-year-old life is flashing from my eyes, but I tell him, nope. You know, I just, with all due respect, I don't judge. I have no bias, no prejudice. I personally don't play that way. Takes him a minute to sink that in, focuses, and gives me this sneer I'll never forget. It says, Kevin, you young fuck, don't flatter yourself. Even if I did roll that way, which I don't, I would not want your young, ugly ass. So I've never been more relieved and happy to hear that somebody thought I was young and ugly and had a nasty ass than that moment. That was awesome. I'm not going to lose my job. But you're going to learn about wine tonight, you young fuck. So we stagger downstairs. It's now 2 a.m. and we go past the wine cellar into the wine vault. And this is where the Margaux and the Pomerol and the Rothschild and the La Coya and the Screaming Eagle. And he pulls down something that would be $4,000 today. Right, inflation adjustment, a 1962 Petrus. Wow. And here you go. Just picture this. This weird eccentric billionaire weirdo has got the 19-year-old college kid in the vault in the basement drinking a $4,000 bottle of wine. And that began 3 nights a week for 2.5 years through my entire undergraduate. I got this education from this freak.
Incredible.
But this freak that, you know, so you couldn't buy this education today. So, I mean, talk about having the heroin needle stuck up my arm. So the good news is, you know, I graduated with a hell of a palate, and that's been good for career and entertainment and all that. The bad news is, you know, I graduate with this Rolls Royce budget and this 10-speed bicycle, this Rolls Royce palate and this 10-speed bicycle budget. And boy, was that good motivation to get my ass earning some money because I couldn't afford my juice anymore, right? And I was like in DTs, trembling like a heroin addict, getting off of his good juice. So that's how I lined wine. And then forever, right? Wine is in every corner of art in our civilization, every corner of history. People go to war, right? Napoleon went to war to go get champagne, right? Hitler went after the wine regions. I mean, history, romance, theater, movies, religion, right? The Last Supper, we had vino, right? I mean, everything. It is about the sexiest thing in the world. It's the most prolific thing, and it permeates every single thing. And finally, it's deeply personal, right? Because it doesn't matter how much I know, you know, it's personal. If you think it's good wine, it's good, right? You can think a $10,000 bottle of wine tastes like shit, but if it's good to you, it's good to you. So it's also deeply personal and individualized, in addition to all that sensationalism that I just got it. So yeah, Jonathan, I've probably bored your audience enough about wine.
No.
To say that I am a wine freak and a cork dork and an enophile would be an understatement because it's a non-trivial part of what I, when you stack up the things that I enjoy, like live sports and live music and traveling, you know, wine is definitely a top five, if not a top three in my entire life, as far as my hedonism and my debauchery and the things that I really enjoy in life.
No, I think the thing that I love about you, Kevin, is that you're always honest. But here's the thing, you more than anyone taught me about palate. Mm-hmm. And that was a very mind expanding idea to me that I had never thought about is you don't have to love every wine. You just got to love the wines you love, which releases criticism of everything else. Like, I don't like Two Buck Chuck. I don't. I like really good wines. They have a distinct. We went to dinner a couple of weeks ago and you ordered, you said, I want it to be chalky. And I thought, fuck, he's just figured that out. Yeah. Like that is knowledge that is so keen.
Yep.
And to know your palate is to know yourself. It really
to know your palate is to know yourself. That's a really good, I think that is a profound and astute, and I wish we could spend an hour on that statement alone because it is true. And then, yeah, the final thing is then, like with most things in life, which I'm sure we'll talk about, there is the part of whatever it is, let's use wine, but then there's lots of other things on its own, right? And what good wine means on its own, right, is very different than in context, right? So good wine with a piece of chocolate or strawberry, mm-hmm. or a piece mm-hmm. of cheese or a piece of red meat or, right, a fish. The definition of good wine can completely change when it's in the context of something else. And that's a metaphor, right, for things we like in life on their own is one thing, very powerful, very poignant, very yummy and tasty, or nasty and sick, right? You put it in context, and in this case, right, the metaphor is wine and food, but it's a metaphor for everything. You put it in context, it can be completely different. It can be really different on each different thing, right? So not only is that true about wine, if you really wanted to geek out about it, it's a great metaphor for, you know, kind of most of what us human beings are thinking and doing, you know, bumping around this earth. It kind of fits almost everywhere. So another reason I like wine is you can extend it into why Sherpa stuff and mysticism, like I just tried to do there. And it kind of works.
you reminded me of this story that I had with my team as we were starting to get into wine when I worked for ADP, and we'd won this quarterly dinner. So with this great Santa Barbara restaurant called Citronelle. And here you've got back when we're talking 2000, right? So you've got an $85 bottle of Camus, right? Which is a nice Cabernet from Napa, from the Wagner family. Back then when it was less, let's say cough syrupy, and it was more nuanced and balanced. And then you had a Bordeaux. And we're like, you know what?
I agree with that. By the way, Rich, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I do agree with that.
Because you would know.
I do agree with that.
Naomi, even if the Pinots, Bella Gloss, all this stuff, it's like, oh God, please, no, 15% Pinots, right? So we say, let's go with a Bordeaux. And I think that our palates weren't used to it. We said, damn it, we should have just gotten that fruit forward Camus. And then fast forward about 5 or 7 years, my uncle, who's married to a woman from Quebec, and so they've been drinking a lot of French wine. The first time, it's got to be the Chateau Léoville Barton or something like that. It's just a great, it's a left bank Bordeaux. And my mom's cooked this amazing buttery filet. And I cut into this thing and I have a bite and I go, what was that? That complement, that perfect blend. And now I started to realize I've never had that experience before where you're talking about perfect balance and harmony. And like, it's like, okay, eureka. Now I think I know. And now, of course, we actually have as much or more foreign stuff, you know, in our wine cellar. To that wine cellar, to wine
fruit. And wine is a really good and poignant example of that. But like I said, you can actually extrapolate that to pairings, if you will, across every facet of your life. So it is a pretty cool metaphor for life too. And I'll say one more thing, because I'm guessing, Jonathan, we're probably going to hop to like career and work for a second, but it also, for anybody that wants to like be in private equity or investment banking or VC or be in sales or customer service or knowing wine is actually pretty good for your career too. For those pragmatists that are not jamming on our esoteric discussion about wine right now,
We don't care.
It's also goddamn good for your career. It's really, really good for your career. I'll say that as well. Yeah.
Kevin, I will jump because I could talk about wine. We could do a wine episode. But let's jump forward because you're this kid who had this ridiculous experience coming from pretty strong poverty in Missouri to sitting. You started at Microsoft, right?
No, I was too dumb to take the Microsoft job. I'd be off, you know, on the island I owned right now. I passed up on a job at Microsoft in 1986. So you know, make sure your audience does what I say, not what I do. Okay.
No, but the point I'm making is that you have consistently chosen, and I think chosen is the right word, because you and I have had a lot of conversations around privilege and having access to wealth. You didn't. You started from scratch with nothing.
Very
you
poor.
Just made it work.
Yeah.
You created a life. And I think that's part of the wine conversation, is you don't bring a level of, it's just great wine. You appreciate it.
Yeah.
That to me is why wine is valuable, is because it's, mm-hmm. there's a flavor profile about wine that you bring to it, that you taught me, that was profound. And it comes from that story of having nothing to something.
Yeah.
What was that like for you, bro?
Let's see. I don't know if I was lucky or good, or I'm just remembering it completely wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the reasons, and you articulated, yeah, I mean, we were literally on food stamps. We started cutting wood in July in 97 degree humidity and 110 degree heat, because we heated the wood stove. We heated the house by wood stove. Mm-hmm. We grew what we ate. I mean, it was real poverty, like below the poverty line, to, you know, I life doesn't suck now. And I'm eternally grateful for that. So I kind of somehow along the line, but I think these were a little bit embedded, and there's no way I could have articulated them when I was younger. I think looking back, you know, I can kind of articulate them now. And it's kind of like my little seven things that I think of the answer to your question. Jonathan, so if I can have permission, I'll geek out on those seven, right, that we can go anywhere right. You want.
But
yeah, you know, one of them is intentionality mm-hmm. and having a plan.
Yes, I think that's number one.
And I literally, when I was slopping pigs at 5 a.m. at age 16 in Deliverance Country on the Arkansas, Missouri, told myself I was going to be a CEO, a white collar CEO someday. And I started planning it right ever since. So I think I can kind of, component one is that intentionality and having a plan. And I literally fast forwarded to age 40 when I was going to be CEO. Well, where do I need to be at 38 in this stage? And where do I need to be at 36? And where do I need to be at 30? I literally went backwards. Right. And that kind of ended up being a pretty good roadmap. It's like, okay, that's going to take me 30 steps. I better start busting ass, because by 21, I better be by step two. And by, you know, 25, I better be at step four. So that concept of intentionality and having a plan, not just in career, but in life, because it wasn't just career. Right. It was everything. Right. I mean, the second one is kind of this concept of not just empathy, but comprehension. Because it's one thing to be empathetic, but you got to understand what you're empathizing with, right? And along with that, kind of communication and transparency. So am I going to be empathetic? What do I want? Well, God, what do I want from my coworkers? What do I want from my bosses? What do I want from my peers? What do I want from my family? What do I want from my teachers, my professors, my mentors, right? Whatever. And more importantly, comprehending what to do with that to further my goals, right? Not selfishly, but right. If I'm going to do it, it's going to be because I'm helping everybody else in that entire ecosystem win with me. Otherwise, I'll lose, right? And then that transparency and communication. I remember being 22, winning sales rep of the year for a Fortune 500 company, sitting down with the CEO of a Fortune 300 company saying, I'm going to have your job in 30 years and I want you to tell me how to get there, right? So transparency and communication, but not selfish. How can I do what I do so that I can get there and you go with me, right? So I think that's a big second one, is that not just empathy, but comprehension, and not just communication, but transparency, kind of two. Three, and I generally, this is more of a life thing than a career thing, but, you know, being a well-rounded athlete rather than just a position player, right? And Jonathan, you and I mean, we geek out on the Warriors all the time. Do you want somebody that's just a great point guard? Or do you want somebody that can actually play all four positions of five on the floor, right? And normally, right, in life and in business, how do I make sure that I'm not just a three or just a four or just a two? No, I want to be a great athlete that can play the floor. And again, the sports analogy, but roll it out to every facet of life.
That argument, Kevin, that argument is one of the reasons why I think my Magic Johnson is in the conversation of greatest of all time.
All the time.
Because...
And he could do it in inner city youth and in business and in endorsements, right? He took it in sports. He also believed it in life. I took it in sports mm-hmm. and I also believed it in life, right? And look at people like Magic that are billionaires now because they took that approach, right?
Yeah.
During and I think his playing career, but more importantly, in his entire life, not just his playing career.
And also to develop partnerships and develop a rapport, right? The reason why Kobe...
Every point of the compass. Exactly. Yep. That's right.
Kobe was more beloved than MJ. Was MJ exactly perhaps right. the greatest? But no, Kobe was more beloved. When MJ... Exactly right. when if MJ...
And more well-rounded and better corporate citizen.
You know, and, all of this. And, yeah. You got it.
And then four is kind of, and again, this is a life thing and a career thing. You got to fucking have work ethic. Pardon my French. I hope that's okay.
No, we can say
you need work ethic. You need to be willing to put in the work. No entitlement, no silver spoon. I don't care how lucky you are. I don't care how good looking you are. I don't care how smart you are. And again, I've got a pretty high IQ. You know, I'm decently charismatic, you know, all that. No. I worked my you know what off for 30 years, right? So I do think, and especially today, I think that one's a little bit lacking, which is why I wanted to make sure I said to the audience is, I feel like work ethic is a bit of a dying breed. And that's not me being the old man grousing about the young.
I think that's reasonable.
It just is. So work ethic is my fourth one. Seeing around corners and not being content with just looking at what's in front of you, but forcing yourself to go look at those chess moves out. What's coming, the ripple effects. I mean, a lot of your audience probably understands the butterfly effect, right? This little butterfly here, something happens around the world. They're close. If I do this, or if this isn't right, what's four steps ahead and around the corner that I can't even see, but I'm going to force myself, you know, around the corner. That's a big one. That's career and life. The second to last one is just balance. You know, you can't just be a world-class athlete. You can't just be a world-class CEO. You can't just be a world-class. You better have some balance or, you know, you're just going to tip over, right? Because
balance
at some
EQ time, or work-life balance or some kind of everything.
Creative quotient versus EQ versus IQ. Friendship is a social life versus working 700 hours a week, right? Sleep versus being the top of the leaderboard. Health versus, right, W-2 and money. You name it, right? People that are hungry for success in anything. It could be marriage, it could be a relationship, it could be career, it could be an up-and-coming winemaker, it could be a budding CEO, it could be an athlete. People that allow themselves to get myopically, singularly focused, ironically, hurt their quest to be the absolute best of the one thing because they're so single-threaded and so myopic on that one thing. They don't even realize they're actually hurting their progress against that because that lack of balance actually hurts them. And the last one, it's a little bit tied to that, is just, you know, life, career is a team sport. Climbing the ladder to CEO is a team sport. Life's a team sport, right? You know, your kids, your family, your friends, your mentors, your coaches, your bosses, your board members, your, right, whatever. Anybody that thinks that they can do it all themselves because they're that badass, instead of saying, nope, this is a team sport. It takes a village. Pick all your euphemisms that we've all read in all the business books. But bottom line is team outperforms I, right, all the time, right? And you can be an elite athlete and solo, and you'll put up a lot of points on the board, again, in life, in work, in money, in whatever. Or you can be an elite athlete that surrounds him or herself with team. Then you win championships. Then you win rings in life, in money, in love, in business, right? So it's not just a career thing, it's a life thing. So Rich and Jonathan, there you go. There's Aykroyd's like Sherpa wise guy, kind of seven things. There was a really long-winded answer to Jonathan's question is, and again, I don't think I was able to articulate that. I know I wasn't able to articulate it earlier, but now with the insight of some old age and some gray hair and thinking about how that happened, which is what your question, Jonathan, was, I think that's kind of it, is I somehow inherently had that little recipe, you know, and earlier in my life, I was doing it without realizing it. Later in my life, I'm very, very intentional about it to make sure that I'm hitting all seven of those, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think that's, Kevin, that's one of the things I appreciate about you the most is you're not a caricature. You know, you're a very successful CEO. You've taken a company public.
That was fun. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, you've been the journey of a CEO at a very large level.
Mm-hmm.
but you've maintained your own sense of humanity. And I think that's why you and I get along really well, is because you're interested in that side.
For sure.
You're not a character. And so I think that's what I wanted to kind of ping you on, is ask you, is for the world outside, because that's the CEO club is an extremely exclusive club.
It is.
Okay. And there's no knock on that at all.
Yeah. That's not a good thing or bad thing. It is. Whether you like it or not, whether it's good or bad, it is. Yes.
Right. It's what is that life like from the inside? Not the outside, but from the inside.
Let's see. That's a great question. One, and this might be the most cliche, overused statement in the world, because I think everybody at one point in time has heard it's lonely at the top. That actually is true. You don't have any peers left, right? You're it, right? And it makes that team and balance thing even more important. So like, I have to realize I don't have any peers. So Jonathan, as you know, I belong to a couple of those peer-to-peer CEO groups, not because we think we somehow have this right to go spend a bunch of money and be elite CEOs talking to each other. It's to say, well, fuck, you are the one that understands me, because, right, I have 4,000 employees right now and I love every one of them, but none of them are me, right? So that whole it's lonely at the top thing is a thing, number one. Number two, so that one, the myth and the cliche that you've heard 1,000 times is lonely at the top, 100% true. The second one, shit rolls downhill, mm-hmm. is 100% false. No, shit rolls uphill, people. You are on the hook and responsible and to blame for everything. Doesn't matter.
Give me an example. Okay.
Somebody doesn't tighten a bolt on a plane and Boeing, and who's testifying in front of Congress and ready to go to prison because a mechanic didn't tighten a bolt? It's not the mechanic. The CEO,
Mulally would never would have let that happen. I'm glad you mentioned that. I just saw that, right?
Yeah. Literally everything, and it's a double-edged sword, right? When things are going great, you get way more credit than you deserve, which is awesome.
Yeah.
When things go sideways, you get way more blame than you deserve, and you just have to realize that is part of it, right? But shit rolls uphill. It doesn't roll downhill. So I want your audience to take that away. If you want to be a CEO, realize that you're not the one defecating downhill. You're the one receiving uphill, and just be ready for that if you want the CEO job. The third answer to that I would give you is that you need to, and it kind of goes down to that position player. If you're a CEO, you don't just have to be a really good leader, right? That's important. You don't just have to be a really good visionary, seeing around corners. That's important. You don't just have to be a very good business person. You know, that's important. You better be a good therapist. You better be a good coach. You better be a good public speaker. You better be, right, empathetic. You better be, right, you need to be an extraordinarily well-rounded person. So you don't have the luxury of just slacking and saying, nah, no, I just want to be that myopic, single-minded, somewhat egotistical sales rep that doesn't care about anything but hitting my number and making everybody else look bad on the leaderboard. No, you just don't get to do that, right? So you need to be, you're kind of, you know, everything. And then last thing, if I could keep going, and I think this one, and this again is, so I'm the king of cliches on this one, but I love this one because this one is so true. You know, we've all heard it, right? With great power comes with great responsibility. That's the thing. You have the power, but you also have the responsibility. It's your responsibility to fill in the blank, right? And people really need to realize that, because it sounds great. I'm going to make a bunch of money. I'm going to be on the website. I'm calling the shots. It's like, well, okay, that's true. But are you ready to change diapers and be the therapist and clean after messes and be blamed for everything, you know, and be lonely at the top? And if you are, awesome, because it's the best job in the world. And I wouldn't change it for anything. But, you know, my perception of it when I was 20 in business school about how glorious and glamorous and easy street and awesome and carefree it was going to be versus the reality of being a multiple time CEO, all that other stuff I just rattled off, it's not good or bad. It just is. So you just need to realize that if that's what you're aspiring to, you know, all that comes with it. It's not just the title, right? You got to be ready for all of it. And most of it is not that sexy, glamorous thing we think of when we're 20. Most of it's like the real crap, right? And dealing with the
wine business.
Yeah, exactly.
The wine, it's not all sexy with the bottle and the estate. It's the hands getting dirty. It's the harvest, right? There's so much more behind the scenes.
Yep. Exactly. And again, if you're willing to do it, awesome. And if you appreciate that, it probably makes you a better CEO, right? Because you're willing to bite all that off, right? If you're not willing to do it, the people that don't like that, don't want to put in the work and don't like all that, are the people that usually don't sit in the chair very long. Yeah. Because they realize, ugh, this isn't what I thought. Or their board of directors and their employees and their customers realize that and you know, they get bounced. So you need to go into that wide open if you want that job someday.
I've never asked you this question. Did you ever want to quit?
No.
Being a CEO? You've always wanted it. And why? Okay, now you've been doing it for a very long time.
I have, yeah.
Why was it the fulfillment that you thought it was?
1,000%. Because Jonathan, as you know, right? Yeah. I love being a father. I love being a coach. I love being a mentor. I love consulting. That nurtures like those 4,000 employees that work for me.
You have a great mind too.
They're like my children. They're my right. I mean, I take pride in raising my 4,000 children well.
Yeah.
I measure my own success. As you know, Jonathan, my success measurement is no longer my career. It's how many of my alumni assumption. And so like, you know, we talk about football a lot. Well, some people, their greatest claim to fame is that their assistant coaches, now five of their assistant coaches are head coaches in the NFL, right? That's how I look at it now. I've been a multiple-time CEO, Now I can go look around the table and go, seven or eight or nine of my assistant coaches, my senior levelship, now they're in CEO jobs or they're in COO jobs or they're in chairman boards or they're in, you know, running. So the gratification level is so incredibly high. And again, you need to be wired this way, right? What I'm talking about needs to matter to you. But if it does, it makes all that blood, sweat, and tears and shit rolling uphill and babysitting and therapy sessions intensely gratifying, intensely worth it. And because I am a sick bastard wired that way, I love the CEO job.
Yeah.
I really love it for those reasons. Yeah.
Well, I had to ask you this. One of the reasons why we have people on Living in the Matrix is because they do things outside of the status quo. And there's certainly things I think that you would follow down the cliched route of being a CEO. But when I looked at your profile, I realized that we had 40 connections plus in common on LinkedIn. And I said to myself, I have not seen a lot of CEOs where I've got that kind of connectivity. And so my question for you is, why are you so willing and open to have such a great open relationship with so many different people from ADP, from, you know, Seattle stuff, from LinkedIn? I've seen lots of different shared connections. What is the reason why you're so open to have that kind of connection? Because your time is valuable, right?
Yeah, no, it is. And again, we talked about that. If I'm going to be a great athlete and play all five positions instead of one, I can't be select. That by definition means I got to be broad in that aperture. If I'm going to be a developer, a nurturer, a coach, a servant leader, and it is my job to develop you and make you better, I don't want that, you know, by definition means I'm going to try to broad that. If I believe what I said, that I need to empathize and understand, right? I don't need to empathize and understand the top 200 people that look, smell, and feel exactly like me and have the same Stanford MBA and the same CEO title. I need to understand what all 27,000 of those LinkedIn connections, right? I want my understanding and empathy to be this broad, right? And one, it's personally gratifying. And two, that's the thing. It makes you better. It actually makes you better because your aperture and your worldview and your empathy and your understanding and the connections you can make and the right and your ability, right? If you do that, it's work. I mean, it's work, right? But holy smokes, it makes your life better. And it certainly makes your career better. If that makes sense, Rich. Yeah.
No, I can testify, Rich, to that. I've sat at dinner with his line managers, the guys on his core leadership team. And Kevin, to me, is probably one of the best examples that I've experienced where he believes in what he says. Like he sympathizes and believes in his people. That's his operating procedure. And I think that's what makes you unique, Kevin, is you do have a heart because I think, and this is where I want to dovetail into, is we are in sort of a unique time in history where the scale, you and I have talked about this at dinner, is the scales are out of balance.
They are, for sure.
Deeply.
For sure.
And you bring a perspective. What is the conversation inside around that?
Yeah, boy, I wish we had 10 hours to talk about this. I'm going to go back to a couple of themes that I just did. But again, I'm going to go back for a second to my third thing. And forgive me for being repetitive, Jonathan, it's a really important piece to what you just said.
Yeah.
We are the most effed up we've ever been. Mm-hmm. We're the most divided we've ever been. We're the most lost we've ever been. We're the most confused we've ever been. We are the most against each other that we've ever been. I mean, I could just go on and on and on, right?
Yeah.
What's the first, if you want to do anything about that, what's the first thing you need to do? You need to empathize and comprehend. Can you actually say, you know, instead of judging the 992 points of view that I don't believe in personally, which is easy to do. I'm right. The other 922 are fucking morons, right? No. If you take the time and not just empathize, empathy means I get it. I understand. And I want to be receptive to all these other racial, socioeconomic, religious, I mean, you name it, right? I mean, the divides are immense. Let me empathize and understand where you're coming from. Right? Let me empathize, feel. More important, let me comprehend. Well, why do you feel that way? Why do you think that way? Because that's the key. Oh, okay. If I understand, if I take the time to empathize, and then I actually take a few minutes to just freaking get it and comprehend, boy, I wish about a billion of us would do that. Because if we did, then we'd stop taking this fuck you, I'm right, you're wrong approach, which leads to the wars and the racial divisions and the socioeconomic divisions, the political divisions and the gendered religions and the socioeconomic religions. It's because we don't empathize. A, we're too jaded, we're too hard. We don't think we need to empathize. And way more important, we don't comprehend because we don't want to, right? And if we just did that, that would be a foundation. And then if we could just be transparent and say, hey, Jonathan, I know you feel this way about, pick your topic. I know you, let me be transparent. I know you feel this way about whatever it is, guns, drugs, religion, politics, right? Same set, whatever, pick your topic. Let me communicate and be transparent to you about why I feel like I do. And holy smokes, if we just do those two things, empathize and comprehend, and then talk about it transparently with that comprehension and empathy in it, man, I feel like we would take some pretty major steps towards getting our act together again as a planet. And I realize that sounds very professorial or philosophical, but I kind of genuinely believe it. And it's why it's one of my key tenets. Because I, like I said, I don't think that's just a career thing. I think that's a life thing. And I do think, not that I would ever espouse to give the human race advice, but if I did give the human race advice, I think that's the most important one. Because boy, if we could actually just have an ounce of that, what I just rattled off, man, we would be a different place. We really would.
Yeah. Do you think, things, let me dovetail on this real quick, Rich. That's the thing that I think I've learned the most about in this podcast. I thought, when we started this podcast, I thought, I'd have a great conversations. But I was blown away by when I interviewed people that were on the opposite spectrum of us. And I listen and empathize. It radically changed me.
Yeah, big time. Big really time. Cool. Yep. Yeah.
Sorry, Rich, go ahead.
I was going to say, the person that I'm thinking of in the political debates that most characterizes what you're talking about is Vivek. I've seen a lot of people in the audience have this confrontational. He seems like he tries to listen. He's very good at articulating his own position, of course, many times. But does it feel like he's doing an honest effort in trying to bring that to at least from a political standpoint? Or can you give another example?
It does. And let me jujitsu that back again, because again, that's part of being a CEO role.
Sure.
Because I do that, and again, this isn't me, but just people like me that do that, then when it is time for you to corral, take the reins, make decisions, get people behind you and go again, whether it's leading the country or whether it's leading a company or whether it's leading a military battalion or whether it's leading a peace effort, right, with medical or whatever, you do have, then the leader has to emerge. The leader has to take control again. The leader has to lead and get the following and get the conviction of the followers to go. Otherwise, nothing works, right? And again, whether that's a nonprofit, whether that's a corporation, whether that's a military effort, a nonprofit effort, a peacekeeping effort, a philanthropy effort, a clean water effort, fill in the blank, right? Everything. The leader has to step back up and lead and effectively lead and have that following come with them. I'm just suggesting that if you take that step first, your success as a military or a philanthropic or a scientific or an academic or a philanthropic leader or a business leader like me, you take that first step, the room you create for yourself to be an effective leader in the second step is order of magnitudes higher than if you skip that first step. If that makes sense, Rich, I hope it does.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And again, that doesn't just apply to being a CEO in business like I am. That applies to any leader in anything, right, across the board. That principle applies to everything, no matter what it is, in my humble opinion.
No, I love the common thread you've got to have, right? I mean, you find the shared things, right? There's so much diversity, but then you find the common weavings of the humanity, of the perspective. I mean, as much as diverse as that things are, right? There are the common threads, and that it's the idea
Talk about them, be transparent, realize that, hey.
Yes.
And then, you know what? Let's freaking chart a path. And, you know, another thing I learned, hey, if 100% of us are 80% happy, versus if 80% of us are 100% happy, we're way better off. We're not all going to be 100% happy, right? That's not what it looks like. That's impossible in this world, again, no matter what it is. But we're going to find some common ground. And even when I am here, you empathized, you understood, you talked to me about it, you were transparent about yours. So when you tell me, hey, I'm going to go the happy medium ground in business or in politics or in whatever, all 10,000 of those people that might be a little to the left of you, a little right of you, they're going to follow you. If you skip that step, they're all going to go, hey, screw you. Yeah, exactly. Simple, but insanely powerful in everything. Again, science, academics, military, healthcare, politics, it doesn't matter. That's the approach you got to do if you want to effectively lead and have a big following versus lead and constantly be talking in an echo chamber because most of your audience is not hearing you, right? And back to your, I happen to think that specific politician is actually doing a decent job.
Great.
Yeah. But I think that's what it takes, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Kevin, so what do you think is a way through the inequality? Because I think ultimately we speak from the side.
Oh man.
I know, I want to open a can of worms because that's partly what this conversation was about, is you bring a unique perspective. And I'm not saying throw anyone under the bus, because what I appreciate about you is your empathy. Yeah. You're not trashing people. I know you're not going to do that.
No.
But there's, we are not in the same place we were when we were kids.
For sure.
We're all relatively the same age. When we were, you know, 40 years ago, it was a very different world that we lived in, and now it's expanded. And AI, so AI is going to throw a wrench into things because it's going to 100x. Like the internet was 1x. That's what they're equating it. AI is 100x in terms of change. How do we begin addressing the inequality in a world that is really going to, in the future, be about superfluous abundance?
Man, that's a great question. Boy, I feel about 1% qualified to answer that. My gosh,
yeah,
that's
above, you have a good perspective.
That's so above my pay grade, man. You give me way too much credit to even touch that question. That's sad, even though I'm only 1% qualified to answer it. I think there's a couple things. One, everything that we just talked about is mission critical to addressing that too, right? So just cut paste, right? Two, I do think that, and I actually genuinely think that most of the 8 billion people in the world want this.
Mm-hmm.
We somehow have to figure our way back. We don't want dictatorship or tyranny, right? Or Gestapo or Banana Republic. We have shifted so far over to anarchy, everything goes, right? Even in this country. You know, and I can point, I can point to things that would affect 1% of the population, but make up 50% of the clickbait online every day, right? That's got to stop, right? So we have to come back, and we have to have leaders that can do the stuff that we talked about 10 minutes ago, mm-hmm. that can actually bring the flock back in a little bit to say, yeah, we didn't like this, but can't we actually agree that this is freaking madness? The fact that you were willing to go shoot somebody to defend the right for assault, right? you're so far gone that you think that you would rather shoot 20 people with your assault rifle before they take your gun away because they just shot 100 people in a grade school. Can we acknowledge that might be a little far off, right? Can we acknowledge that 6'4" dudes that are hung like a horse probably shouldn't be in grade school girls' bathrooms in the answer of equality, right? What we're calling equality, I have the right to be a 6'4" dude that walks into a junior high girls' bathroom. No, I have the right to keep my World War II assault rifle that can mow down 700 people in self-defense. No. And again, I'm not expressing opinions. Right. I are personal. I'm saying we have somehow got to get some leaders that can make people realize that most of the inequality, right, is this extremism. And boy, we would That's solve fair. For that inequality yeah. better if we just kind of came back a little bit to, right, kind of common ground, common sense, common good, et cetera. That's my closest stab at it, Jonathan, is until we solve for that, right? And then on top of that, unfortunately, and this might be a little bit controversial, but I'll go ahead and say it. Because I don't know. I mean, I'm in my 50s. I think anybody in their 30s and below literally take our digital social online media as gospel. And the lack of responsibility around there, I think, is the single biggest kind of flame on the fire to this. So in addition to getting some leadership that doesn't squash any of this and isn't right or left, isn't correct, I'm right, you're wrong, we somehow get ourselves back to leadership, again, political, corporate, academic, military, social, that gets the 7 billion people that thrive on gnawing on their particular flavor of inequality and loving to exasperate it into realizing it's kind of group insanity and let's just come back. And then two, we somehow have to figure out how to, because this, I realize how confrontational it is, but we've kind of allowed ourselves to just freaking like, when I was in business school, last in, first out, LIFO is an old CPA term. Mm-hmm. If I saw it on Instagram, it's what I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the abuse is there. Right. And I'm not even gonna go there with free speech versus censorship and all that. But we have to acknowledge that that is where 6.5 of the 8 billion people literally have their opinions formed and reformed and reformed and reformed and reformed. So I personally believe that there does need to be some kind, and I don't recommend censorship. I don't recommend nationalizing the social media networks. I don't know what the solution is, but if we don't get the goal of ourselves to not be inequality and divisiveness, but actually finding a way back, A. And we don't stop the flamethrower gas on the fire, right, that happens every second of every day, then I think we're doomed. So Jonathan, I don't know the answer. I do think that I know what those two problems are. And in my mind, those are the ones we got to solve for. How is above my pay grade, but I do think those are some of the reasons, things we're going to have to get over.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more of a practical question.
And Jonathan, I have a five. I've got about five more minutes. Is that okay?
Oh, no worries.
Okay,
no,
perfect. Yeah, okay.
Let me ask you the practical question then is, how does something like Boeing happen? Is it a lack of concern? Is it a drive for profit? What is your perspective on that? And I know you don't know the insides, but you kind of have a feeling of organizations and how that could happen. How does that
backyard.
Happen?
Yeah.
Right. That is true.
It's in your backyard. That's right.
Yeah. No, that is true. My personal opinion is that it goes back to that comprehension, transparency, communication, right? And I'm going to give you, and by the way, let me be very clear. I'm not suggesting that this was the case. I know a lot of people in news media are suggesting that case. I am not, to be really clear. I'm not pointing a finger. However, if you were a leader and you said the only thing that matters is the stock price, and I'm going to get you to capitulate and agree with me because I'm going to give you 100 RSUs so you care about the stock price too, and the only thing that matters is that stock price, then, okay, am I going to cut corners? Yeah. Am I miss quality? Yeah. Am I not going to report to my superiors? I'm worried. Yeah. And I'm going to skip quality, right? I mean, and again, I'm not saying that's happened, but it's a good example where if I'm allowed to go down to that, well, I don't understand why me not doing that thing right, because I want to get to my lunch break. If I'm not empathetic to the fact that 2.5 million people might die if I do my job properly, if I don't understand, this isn't me getting to lunch 5 minutes earlier, right? This is me keeping those 2.5 million people safe. If leadership doesn't communicate, hey, yes, the stock price is important. What's more important is quality, reputation, our customers' lives, et cetera. And if the culture of an organization isn't transparency, you know what? And if transparency is, you know what? Shit, I got to ship that product 3 months later because it ain't where it needs to be. And again, I'm not suggesting or inferring, but that's the kind of thing that could happen if you go down that path versus the one that I'm kind of suggesting is a better path, if that makes sense.
No, I think it's ultimately, you and I have talked about this over dinner, is I think the culture of capitalism has shifted from when we were kids.
Unfortunately, yes. It's not about what it was. It is a few elite people that don't have empathy, don't have comprehension, don't communicate, don't have transparency, don't believe it's a team sport, are fine with the inequality and division for their own. It's systemic, right? And unfortunately, that's kind of where we sit right now. And we do need to inject ourselves a little bit more into, you know, and again, now I'm sounding like a politician or a philanthropist, but I do agree with you, Jonathan. I do, as a person, not necessarily as a CEO, but as a person, I really agree with what you're saying.
Well, let me close with this, because I know you got to go.
I don't get the last question. You usually give me the last question.
Oh, no, I'll give you one quick one.
It's a fast one. I think I know the answer.
How does let's just keep the United States, begin shifting back to that sense of empathy?
Boy. Unfortunately, right now, let me just use an example. We cry about data privacy. The same people that cry about data privacy are the exact same people that click, yes, you can use my data however you want to if you give me that 5% off coupon, right? We as 352 million Americans need to stop that because it's self-imposed. And I'm using that just as one example, right? I could give you 1,000 more, right? We need to stop saying out of one side of our mouth, I'm complaining about it, while on the other side, completely capitulating and feeding it. And that was just one good example, right? The 352 million of us actually need to care, right? And then we somehow need to get leadership. And again, I know this is corporate leadership, political leadership, academic leadership, to break out of the beholdencies, right? And realize that, hey, what good looks like, right? And again, another example. I mean, imagine this, Jonathan, and I knew this is a pipe dream. What if the boards and Wall Street rewarded your stock price for social good rather than, right, or for philanthropy, right, or for empathy, right? What if there was a metric about how well you actually did around corporate responsibility, diversity, equity, inclusion, environmental, social governance, right, and giving back, right? What if half your stock price value was those things versus just your EPS and your revenue? Because what happens is all those things are in the way of my EPS and revenue. So I do bad things against all those things, because if I don't, I'm a CEO and I could care about wage rates in my factories. I could care about clean water in my service center in Africa. I could care about diversity. I could, all the things I personally care about. But the only thing that my stockholders and Wall Street and my board is caring about is this. And I'm going to get fired if I don't deliver this. And not have any luxury at all to go influence those things. How we're measured, right? The collective we, how we're measured needs to change. If that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Because the problem is our leaderships are measured in a way that is antithetical to the things that we need to change. And that is a truism that I will stand by. That one I'm happy to go on the record on. Our leadership is measured, compensated, and their job security is completely dependent on stuff that is antithetical to the things that are wrong in our society right now. And I'm talking about the United States specifically. If we can't fix that, we ain't going nowhere.
Yeah. Rich?
Well, it could be pretty fast. It might not be, but you know, Peter Drucker's famous for saying culture eats strategy for breakfast. And so the question, maybe it's not the case for Boeing anymore, but what is the answer to that? Is it a yes or no, and why?
I'm going to put a little, I believe, I'll say it back a little bit. You give me an A strategy and C execution, or a C strategy and A execution. Give me C strategy execution all day, every day, A. And B, one of the fundamental underpinnings around great execution is culture. So if you believe that, if you believe that culture is one of the foundational enablers or disablers of execution, and execution trumps strategy, then I violently agree with Mr. Drucker, if that thread follows.
And this is why, this is why I think we, as a moving forward, until corporate America realizes the necessity of taking care of people,
that's right,
the culture question, we're not going to get back to balance.
But that's my point, Jonathan. Yeah. If I care too much about people and act accordingly, I'll miss my stock price target and I'll get fired. Yeah.
No, so that's the counter.
My own job security is at odds with taking care of my people. Right. That's the point I was making. Until we break that, it ain't going to happen. Yeah.
Okay. It can't be forced, though, because there's a DEI blowback happening right now. Everybody knows McKinsey has proven that a diverse culture is more profitable and more innovative. And I'm all on board with that. But it cannot be forced with a hammer. It's got to be nurtured and inculcated.
And it can't be a shiny object just for its own sake to impress somebody.
100%.
It needs to be a foundational core in the fiber that you believe in. Then it'll work.
Yes.
If it's a shiny object to put up on the investor day once a quarter and it's bullshit, it'll backfire. Yeah, that's exactly right. So we should, I mean, there's an hour long podcast on that topic alone.
We'll probably have
topics that are worth an hour here. Right. So a good, enjoyable conversation, guys. I love it. I hope this is what we were hoping for on a Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. 100%. This is what we always do. We always have great conversations with people. So to all of our listeners, this has been one of my favorites. I say it all the time because I love talking about things that really matter and going back to shit that really matters. And we've been able to do that. So thank you, Kevin, for coming on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So to all of our listeners, please comment, review, let us know. And if you have someone you'd like to have on the show, please let us know.
Have a great weekend, Jess. Yep.